Greetings, listeners, and welcome to Whiskey and International Relations Theory, the podcast which is pretty much what it sounds like. In this fourth episode, Patrick and I finish out our discussion of Cynthia Enloe's Bananas, Beaches, and Bases, Making Feminist Sense of International Politics. Before we start, three production notes. First, this episode clocks in at like 80 minutes, and I swear we will try to keep future episodes shorter, but I suspect we won't succeed. Second, there was a block in the middle of the recording that really should be an outtake. In the end, I was able to remove about half of it, the part where Maya, that's my partner, came down and the three of us chatted for a bit. But I wound up leaving the second half in, so you'll understand why, but it will get a little bit weird about maybe midway through this episode. Finally, our music is performed by Lyra Gemmell-Nexon, and I'll let her transition us into the discussion itself. Important chapter, both in terms of international relations scholarship and then the development of the study of bases as a interdisciplinary activity, which I think we have now. So thoughts about this chapter, preliminary thoughts.
So if there was to be a bumper sticker from this book, it might be page 134, a little quip that she has. Normalcy is always interesting to a feminist investigator. So this is very much it's the denaturalization, broadly speaking, social constructivist, but not in the paradigmatic IR sense, kind of approach, that if we see something that is normal, we have to ask how it's normalized. And that normalization for Enloe always involves gender roles. And asking where are the women is an interesting way of opening up those sorts of implicit or subterranean processes. So the normalcy of the military base is sustained by a whole number of different gendered roles and practices in this chapter. So we have the hyper-masculinized soldier, we have the military wife, we have local women who perform various services, including sexual services, and areas like marriage policy and fraternization policy are the places that she wants to cut in to show us exactly where this kind of, I don't know, part of me wants to call it cultural politics occurs, like where exactly these kinds of boundaries are sustained and policed and maintained. Now, that is something I find that absolutely fascinating, but at the same time, there's something I find a little bit problematic about the way she formulates it. This is, I think, one of the chapters in which the intentionality of policy becomes most apparent as part of the analysis. That she argues over and over here, so particularly I'm looking, thinking of something like page 131, some base policies have been intended to ensure that dissimilar women are unlikely to make common cause. Which just that sentence suggests that the policy is deliberately set up so that these dissimilar women don't get together. That's stronger than a claim that the policy has the effect that dissimilar women can't make common cause. There is a diagnosis of blame that runs throughout this, that these policies are set up to achieve the kinds of effects that they achieve. So that's the part of the chapter that a part of the argument that I find I have a little more trouble with. The observation that the policies do these things, I think, I have no problem with. The idea that they're set up in order to do this is where I start to wonder a little.
Well, I think a lot rides on what you mean by this. So it's very clear in these examples that there is explicit policymaking going on around the quote-unquote problem of miscegenation surrounding U.S. bases. And there are, I may have missed it, but one of the obvious examples of this is Iceland, where the United States doesn't even allow African-American soldiers to serve for a very long time because the Icelandic government is very worried. I mean, even more so, I think, than the British government about, you know, their lily-white women interbreeding and marrying African-American men. So there, I mean, these policies are pretty explicit. I mean, the policymakers are arguing about, you know, is this a problem? Yes, it's a problem. How do we limit the opportunities for black boys to have sex with white girls? There is a lot of intentionality here.
Oh, intentionality about that, I have no question about. It's the intentionality about making sure that dissimilar women are not able to make common cause.
Hmm.
It's that claim that I find a little bit harder to swallow. The claim that people are concerned and policies are explicitly concerned with these racial boundaries. Yes, exactly, because we've got direct evidence of that. We can see those kinds of deliberations going on. Hmm. The claim that there is an almost functional drive in these sorts of policies to prevent patriarchal structures from being challenged.
Hmm.
That's the one that I have a little bit of a harder time with.
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
I think she's absolutely right when she talks about like how military wives' unpaid labor actually makes the base work. The importance of, I mean, one of the other things that lingered with me from reading this book many, many years ago is the analysis of prostitution.
Because and I think this is a really, I mean, this is what everybody remembers, right?
Yeah,
it's not just because it's sordid or, shall we say, exciting for an 18 to 22-year-old reader.
But it was honestly, it was the first
time. But it was revelatory, right?
It was revelatory, and it was particularly, I mean, I've never served in the military, and it was a revelation to me that there was a prostitution policy that effectively bases were set up and that there were ways of regulating what is clearly prostitution, even though they don't call it that necessarily. And of course, this is again one of those things that once you see it, you can't unsee it. And then it's, oh, okay, so then when basing decisions are being made, one of the questions that comes into this is about the local supply of prostitutes.
Hmm.
And that appears to be the case. It's documented, and once you see it, you go, oh wow, that sort of makes sense. If you're trying to think about how you're going to sustain a military base, that this would be something that you should probably take into account. But to me, as a 19-year-old college student, this had not occurred to me as something that you would take into account.
It's reminiscent of the argument, which I don't know if it's actually true, but it's a great story, which is that part of the reason why the Dutch develop such innovative drill techniques that allow contributes to what's called the military revolution. That is, they get people, soldiers who are really able to exercise coordinated actions on the battlefield, is essentially because the Dutch burghers don't want these foreign paid troops running around their towns, getting drunk, smashing things, and having sex with their daughters. And so they hit upon the idea that we'll just drill them constantly. And by the way, that creates a very effective fighting force. I love that story, but it is kind of get at this way that gender is kind of always there. Mm-hmm. When you deal with bases. Because you are just talking about housing a whole bunch of primarily men, although she updates the story and brings the story into now a situation where you have at least in the American military, women soldiers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who are have a lot of the same kinds of duties and responsibilities as male soldiers. And so she has an extensive discussion, not just about violence in military spouses, but also about sexual assaults against female soldiers on bases and the way that these policies have been playing out. Yeah, I'm not sure where I was going with that. I think I was just trying to cover my bases, so to speak.
Ha ha.
Ha ha, yeah.
No, I mean, it's a really fascinating account, and I know I've had students who have utilized this account and this sort of approach to thinking about bases to do really interesting and innovative work when it comes to the production and reproduction of military masculinities. I think of someone like Jesse Crane Sieber, who you know. And Jesse has done some really fascinating work on the everyday performances of masculinity by not just male soldiers, but women. The performance of the kind of masculinity, the shoring up of certain sorts of masculinity by looking at the way videos are sort of circulated on YouTube and the kinds of comments that are made and so on. You can get a sense that everybody's kind of complicit in the production and reproduction of this gendered set of roles. So shoring up the fragile masculinity, normalizing what's really a completely non-normal situation in which men are taken from their families and sent someplace else out into the field, right? There's something very odd about that whole situation. And what Enlow's account does very nicely, and what accounts that follow Enlow's accounts do very nicely, is they denaturalize that and they make it an object of curiosity. Mm-hmm. How does this become normal? How does this become the sort of thing that we think of as just sort of okay? And I think this gives us a lens into that, that other kinds of approaches, sort of mainstream traditional kinds of IR realist approaches, say, don't really take deployment as being anything other than a technical operation. There's no politic. The politics of deployment is figuring out whether to deploy or not, as opposed to Enlow's account, in which the politics of deployment is how do you sustain the deployment? How do you actually make this happen on the ground? So
yeah, there's a lot of work in this idiom now that's worth name-checking. Lally Khalili, who we went to grad school with at Columbia, has a terrific book on the way in which, you know, sort of logistics of American military operations have restructured world politics and restructured the Gulf in particular, if I remember correctly. There's another dynamic here, right? So if your interests are less kind of high theory, it's not just that normalcy is interesting because we ought to denaturalize it, right? We ought to look at how it is possible that things become normal, but because there's a lot of important politics happening in the quote-unquote boring shit, right? I mean, that's the other side of the argument, is that things that we take for granted have power dynamics, right? They have, they're important to them. So you cannot understand how we maintain bases where we maintain bases, this is what you were just saying, without understanding of the political economy surrounding them. And, you know, where I cut into this kind of work, you know, is on the politics of sort of basing and imperial politics broadly. And there, my interest is not in gender, but I would fully agree that unless you understand the quid pro quos, unless you understand the kinds of stakeholders and their positionality that are developed around bases, you cannot understand why these bases persist or do not persist, or the effects they have on reshaping the relations between the United States and other, sometimes clients, sometimes partners, or sometimes just essentially mercenaries who we're paying money to keep our bases there. There are places I think I have some questions about the narrative. So, for example, she argues that she puts a lot of agency on the part of feminist networking against the Subic Bay base. That may be true. That might be a kind of necessary condition. But as I understand it, the Philippine Senate votes 12-1 against keeping the base there in Subic Bay, that it does so largely because the rent package isn't big enough. Right, there is a sense that the United States isn't paying enough. Now, clearly, all the ills the U.S. is creating there probably affects those considerations. But I think she tells this simply as a story of the triumph of, you know, sort of feminist networks, and it's no, and I, you know, that's not how I see the story. And of course, now the United States is back in the Philippines, at least until Duterte firmly kicks us out. And so, you know, there's some moments here where I sort of wonder about where she's putting the kind of emphasis on agency and actorhood.
Right, and I think this goes back to the broader doubleness that we've been talking about throughout the text, where on the one hand, the argument is we need to pay attention to the actions and experiences of women in order to explain certain kinds of outcomes. And on the other hand, we have to pay attention to the actions and experiences of women because we traditionally don't. And that, I don't know, am I ready to call that attention? We're an hour and 20 minutes and several scotches in. I might be ready to call that attention in the argument, that there are these two different kinds of goals. And I'd speculate even further. This is, I think, a tension that is endemic to a more critical approach to theorizing. Are we explaining outcomes, or are we generating explanations which have the consequence or effect of changing existing situations? So in that sense, highlighting the agency of feminist activists with the removal of the space sort of serves one of those streams very well, even if on the other stream it might be a little less of a clear-cut claim to be able to establish that, like, that was actually causally responsible for the removal of the base.
This is also the chapter where the really laudable and I think very powerful and useful emphasis on intersectionality begins to raise some questions for me. There are times when I'm not sure what we're really talking about. I mean, really, really, right, in the sense of sort of what the more important dynamic there is kind of racial imperialist and how much the dynamic is gender. Now, I buy her argument that gender permeates all of this. So in a sense, you can kind of wave this potential contradiction away, and I'm cool with that. There are times when some of the things that she seems outraged about really aren't primarily about, there may be gendered aspects to them, but they're primarily kind of, you know, about the United States being a hegemon and doing hegemonic things. The example of that is her discussion of Diego Garcia, for example, right? I'm sure there's a gender component there because there's always, as she points out persuasively, a gendered component to all basing arrangements, whether in cause or effect or constitution. But I'm, you know, a sense, you know, there's a sense in which, you know, I wish there was a kind of stronger argument ex ante about how to think about the intersection of different identities. Instead, we get a series of emergent arguments, which makes this a much more readable book and probably a more interesting book if you're not, you know, the kind of person who's been trained from grad school to read the introduction, the conclusion, and then skim through the middle part because you just to see whether it proves the argument. But I do sometimes wish that there was more explicit theorization on this point. And this is something that we talked about before we started recording. This is a book which is full of theory, but is not explicitly theoretical in the way that something like Waltz is or Wendt is or even Cindy Weber's work is, for example. And so it often, it's a very kind of accessible narrative. It's something you can assign to a freshman in college or a first year in college. You see, I caught the gender there. But in some respects, for I think people, it might also be frustrating at times as a result.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, this is sort of as far as possible as you could get away from a set of logically spare propositions that would then be evaluated against evidence or something like that. But it's also far away from the kind of systematic approach to theorizing that we saw in Waltz, mm-hmm. where one has to spell out assumptions and logical implications of assumptions. Not that there isn't that architecture in here, but it's very implicit. And I think in a way, the what you might call the sort of plurivocality of the feminist curiosity for Enloe is on display in not doing that kind of spare articulation. Because feminist curiosity leads you in all sorts of different directions in here. And I'm struck by, at the end of most of her empirical chapters, she'll have a paragraph where she kind of pulls back together all the different ways in which gender was implicated in that chapter. And it's a plethora of things, and it doesn't add up simply to anything. And I think that's part of the point. Performatively, I think that's what the book is doing, is saying, well, gender is encoded into all of these things, in all of these different ways, and in a way it doesn't make sense to differentiate between gender as cause and gender as effect. It's better to simply point to the fact that it's always implicated in both.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that also the other aspect of that, I would just draw a number of, you know, Sharpie lines under, which is that she ends these chapters by saying, you know, if you want to look more at this, what would you look at? What kinds of things might you explore? This book is an invitation to do feminist analysis. It's not an endpoint. It's not an answer.
Right.
And there right. It's very effective. So the chapter on bases, I think, is one of the more powerful chapters in terms of really showing that supposedly core concerns of international relations, international security, or national political economy simply cannot be understood without a gender lens. In fact, I would argue you can't understand anything about American hegemony if you do not understand the basing and access network and its political dynamics, of which gender is clearly implicated in multiple ways. So anything else you want to say about this chapter?
No, I think that actually sets up nicely moving to the next chapter, in which he essentially argues that you can't really understand diplomacy without understanding right. these same kinds of gender dynamics, and in particular, the role of diplomatic wives.
So this chapter is called Diplomatic and Undiplomatic Wives. So since, again, you're taking the lead on this particular work, what are your kind of initial thoughts? What do you have marked down for us?
Well, the main takeaway here for me is diplomacy, what we think of as just a, you know, negotiation among different states, relies on the invisible work of diplomatic wives to succeed, that you can't understand how diplomacy works without taking into account the traditional feminine role of hosting parties and creating informal social settings to create an atmosphere where people, men in this case, can get to know one another, which makes all the official negotiations and diplomatic work easier. So you've got the argument sort of goes in two stages. You've got this argument that in order to understand how diplomacy among men works, you have to take into account the largely invisible work of diplomatic wives. But also, we know that that is the case because we watch the efforts of diplomatic wives and activists in that circle to demand recognition for their efforts and pay for the kinds of work that they're doing. And then because of the existence of, more recently, the existence of female diplomats, that shows up how masculinized the diplomatic field actually is. So you have an explanatory point about where that the role of the women in producing this masculine preserve of diplomacy. And then you have a kind of methodological point about the activism by those women calling attention to the ways in which the system is maintained and the kinds of hitherto invisible work that's actually shoring up the grand edifice of international diplomacy.
And this cycles back nicely to the introduction.
Yes.
Right? Because we have the argument both that we cannot understand something without understanding its gender dynamics, but also we can't really understand it without understanding its explicit gender politics. And here we have broadly understood feminist politics doing important causal and constitutive work in terms of what diplomacy has come to look like now. So sort of everything is kind of going on here, I think.
And you have a very explicit ban on women being diplomats, and you have a very explicit ban on diplomatic wives being employees of the embassies where they are stationed, both of which are being challenged throughout. And she talks through the chapter about how these particular very explicit prohibitions are being challenged, and then the sorts of changes that that wreaks in the practice of diplomacy itself. In a way, right, war and diplomacy are absolutely at the core of traditional high international relations, right? That this is the concern, right?
Diplomacy famously has dropped out of the study of academic IR, or did for many, many years. And diplomacy was kind of relegated to memoirs by diplomats or practitioner courses or practitioner writings. And it's only really been in the last 10 plus years that we've taken another serious run at diplomacy. So in that sense, you can make a case, obviously, that diplomacy is at the heart of IR, but I think when Enlow was writing this, diplomacy was not at the heart of IR, interestingly enough. And so this is a way in which the book contributes not simply in terms of, not simply, right, I have scare quotes around that, in terms of feminist analysis, but actually I think helps to reopen diplomacy as a legitimate scholarly area of analysis.
And I think what's important about that in particular is even though diplomacy wasn't central to the scholarship on international affairs, it was certainly central to the practice of international affairs. And so I think that precisely one of the things she's doing here is calling attention to like things that exist in the world that we should be interested in that we're not, and gosh darn it, why aren't we? And we should be. And when you start being interested in those things, you can't ignore, like she says at the very beginning of that chapter on page 184, right? Most men find this congenial environment outside their offices. The home, the ambassador's official residence, or the homes of lower-ranking diplomats is seen as the place where the trust between men can best be cultivated. And the home is the domain of the wife. So there's, you can't really understand what's going on when male diplomats get together to negotiate something unless you pay attention to these informal ways that those relations are being knit together on a daily basis. So it's, yes, we need to make diplomacy more central, but we also then, when we start looking at diplomacy, we have to make women more central, precisely because of the role into which women have traditionally been relegated when it comes to diplomacy as the diplomatic wife.
And also part of the story, though, is a story, particularly as we bring it up to the present, of women fighting for and winning the right to, as you point out, just be diplomats, but also gender mainstreaming as a concern within diplomacy, both as within a whole variety of issues, human rights, et cetera, but also in the practice of diplomacy itself. And, you know, I still remember when I was at the Pentagon in 2009, Michelle Flournoy was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, and there was an article in the Post or the Times, which was interviewing her about, you know, she was, I think, the first woman to occupy that position. I think she was, but she was certainly a prominent woman to occupy that position. Remember, Madeleine Albright was our first female Secretary of State, and that was in the 90s. But anyway, so Flournoy was, I'm going to get, somebody's going to say you're wrong, you've got the wrong people, and then I'm going to get into trouble, was talking about how as a professional diplomat going on these junkets at one point, or not, they're not junkets, going on these, they are kind of junkets actually, but going on these Munich Security Conference types of things, and she goes somewhere with a bunch of military officers, or somebody does, I think it's Flournoy, and they don't know what to do with her, because the normal thing is that the military officers go to like the politics thing, and the wives are taken shopping. And so the question is, which does she go on, right? You know, this was an issue when she was a more junior level person back, I think, in the 90s, right, in the Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this has been really recent, right, that diplomacy started to catch up. And this is on the American side. And, you know, obviously you can look at the, you know, areas where this has been much more effectively mainstream, like in Scandinavia, for example, or at least in Sweden. But... you know, this raises interesting questions as we have new rising powers, right? China now has more, I just read, has a larger diplomatic network, if you count consulates and embassies, than the United States. Mm. Like, it surpassed the United States last year. And this raises all sorts of interesting questions, like what's going on with Chinese diplomacy in terms of gender dynamics?
Hmm. Fascinating.
And there are a whole bunch of more stories to be told here, both within U.S. and Western diplomacy, but also transnationally, right, in terms of, or internationally, in terms of other countries' diplomatic corps, countries that are standing up diplomatic corps, how much are they taking these as models? How much are they doing different kinds of things? I just think it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, it's definitely an area where there's a lot of flux at the moment, which is fascinating. Mm-hmm. And if we take Enlow's point, then flux in terms of the gendered representation within the diplomatic field is going to show up a lot of things about the gendered nature of that field that might have been otherwise invisible. So I think we already name-checked Ann Towns, but you know, Ann's current project is all about gender and diplomacy. And that's there are other people who are kind of following this particular path. I think it's an interesting time to be watching how these transformations play out. And I think in this way, following Enlow's admonition and having that feminist curiosity and asking where are the women is a particularly productive analytical strategy for trying to explain what's going on here.
But what's also interesting here is that despite some sort of call-outs to like Thatcher, right, and pointing out that during Thatcher years it's still pretty male-dominated and things like that, this is really an American and in England-centered story. Mm-hmm. Right? This is the chapter that is the most Anglophone-centric of any of the chapters. Mm-hmm. I think it's just, to come back to what I said about sort of practices elsewhere, it's an interesting, you know, there's some discussion of EU policy, right? But it is interesting.
I think it also has something to do with her sources, because I think this is the chapter where she was researching material in Britain and was able to use some of that historical archival material. It would be an interesting mm-hmm. question out of this to start looking at how these dynamics play out in other countries.
So this is, I think, a really fascinating chapter. I think this is, again, I just want to underscore that this is a chapter that is not only interesting if you are interested in feminist IR, it is also important in terms of the rediscovery of the practice of diplomacy as an area of scholarly interest.
Yes.
So, the next chapter, chapter 6.
Right. So we've done beaches because we did tourism, and we've done bases, so now we should do bananas, and that's chapter 6.
Any initial thoughts about, or overarching thoughts about this chapter? What's this chapter about?
Bananas. But in... Okay, so I'd say a little bit more than that, right? But in a way, the argument here is a great illustration of what she does in, and she does this for the next several chapters. She chooses a product or a commodity or a particular practice that on the surface doesn't appear to be international politics, and says you can't understand this without taking international politics into account. So here's a banana, and you can't understand why we have bananas, and in particular why we have the bananas that we have, in terms of, it was a great revelation for me the first time I went to Brazil and realized that the category banana was a lot broader than that one particular yellow thing that if you go to a grocery store in the United States and you go to buy a banana, like that's the only thing there is. But there are dozens of different varieties of bananas. But the homogenizing of everything around this particular kind of banana, which is tied up with the political economy of fruit companies or fruit production companies and the way they distribute things to their markets here in the United States, that all of this stuff has these gender dynamics built into it in terms of the marketing of the banana, the interesting interplay between Carmen Miranda and Chiquita Banana, and the way that Carmen Miranda comes to symbolize a certain Latin Americanness, which then gets taken over by the Chiquita Banana ad campaign, which is now encoded into the label that goes on the Chiquita Banana when you buy Chiquita Bananas in the store. So all of these things are connected, that there's a gendering of the marketing of the banana, which is connected with the gendering of Latin America, which is also connected with the gendering of the plantations themselves, which in Enlow's account operate very much like military bases. You have a hypermasculinity of the worker, the male worker. You then have women on the base in the plantation in sort of non-masculine roles, but then you also have a prostitution economy that goes along with this. So it's a replication of the same kind of dynamic. It's interesting to see the same kinds of patterns as she explicated in the base chapter showing up on the plantation. So I think there's an interesting, at least I would read this as an argument about particular practices manifesting themselves in different local contexts, having different kinds of local modifications because of that context. But in a way, it's the same underlying set of questions. It's the same kind of disciplining of masculinity that's going on. And the irony, or the difference in this case, which is, I think, somewhat ironic, is the military base is producing the traditionally coded masculine product of dealing death, and the banana plantation is producing the banana, which is gendered in a very different way as a sort of safe domestic commodity. So there's a different shuffling of the deck, but it's the same kinds of gendering mechanisms going on.
Yeah, I bet this chapter has different resonances if you're the generation before us.
Mm.
So we were born in the 70s, and we remember the Chiquita Banana campaign and the song, right? The I'm Chiquita Banana, and I'm here to say.
Well, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we did not live through the U.S. interventions to save the banana industry, the American banana multinationals, right? So we didn't live through the intervention in Guatemala or the overthrow of our bens.
Right.
And so I think if we were a generation before us, it would be even more obvious that this is pretty central international politics stuff, right, than it is now. And so it's good that the chapter does that work of making sure you understand this. And so if we don't immediately think of U.S. interventions in Latin America as associated with banana multinationals. Think about millennials or Gen Zers, right, for whom this is ancient history.
Right.
So I think that's kind of worth just kind of pointing out.
No, I think so. I mean, for those for whom Banana Republic is just the name of a store.
Or something that the United States might be turning into.
Possibly.
But I mean, Banana Republic isn't just, you know, like a Latin American dictatorship, but it refers to a specific kind of political economy in which the U.S. is deeply implicated in upholding authoritarian, often personalist regimes that have the some of the trappings of being democratic republics, but are anything but, right? Mm-hmm. So, so I thought this was a great chapter. I think... And this is going to be a theme as we get through the rest of the book. You know, we're sort of now in the area where she's doing a kind of nice job of showing the things that we're used to in different domains. Bananas, I think, you know, the inflection there is that it's IPE, which then bleeds over into security, while bases are security that bleed over into IPE, and both of which then she shows have this incredibly gendered component. This kind of argument lives on. I'm thinking about Cindy Weber's work on Conchita Wurst,
yes.
Right? Sort of the way in your sort of point at the outset that this feminism to some degree or feminist IR really is what helps open the door to studying popular culture in international relations.
Yes.
There's another story about this which has to do with Campbell's writing Security, which is something that in international intertextual politics, which is something that I think we've decided we're definitely going to be pursuing in a future podcast.
Yes.
But nonetheless, the way in which once you broaden an understanding of what international politics is, in here we have other kinds of figures who... become focal points for international relations work.
No, exactly. I mean, in the banana chapter in particular, there's a line on page 247 that kind of exemplified some of that for me. Those skins are a reassuring yellow, however, she's talking about how bananas appear as a natural product, because their plants were sprayed with pesticides. The weary traveler can peel the banana without fear, and it's interesting to me that the example she's using here is finding something natural when you're in an airport. And you're making transitions between things, which is an experience that is, shall we say, not unfamiliar for globetrotting academics. We do this where sort of you're in these hermetically sealed environments and you're like, okay, I want something that's not just some prepackaged, but oh, look, there's a banana. Oh, that's natural. That's nature. But of course, why? A traveler can peel the banana without fear because women workers have spent hours in a damp plantation shed washing off that pesticide. So the natural is constructed. The construction is gendered. By choosing that banana, you are at that moment implicated in a whole chain of international practices that are also gendered practices.
I mean, this is very much the way in which feminism as a denaturalizing move owes a debt to classical Marxism, though, right? Because what we're really talking about is... Not what we're really talking about, but what we're talking about is a very similar maneuver to the claim Marx makes when he argues about commodity fetishism, right? That essentially we have a whole system in place that allows us to ignore the conditions and social relations of production. And so the critical move is to then recover those conditions of production that go into the creation of the commodity for us.
That's actually an excellent transition point to the next chapter, because then in the next chapter, when she's talking about, in effect, the social construction of women's labor, and her entry point into this is blue jeans. So once again, we have a commodity that has been fetishized, and she's going to decode the fetishizing.
And by the way, a commodity that Joe Nye explicitly invokes in his late 80s work on soft power as being part of the cultural accoutrement that makes the United States attractive.
And then Samuel Huntington ends up
mocking
by saying, yes, they're wearing blue jeans, but they're shouting death to America. So,
which misses the point entirely.
But again, the idea is that this is still something that's kind of floating around. It's a piece of currency. But so Enloe's argument in this chapter is that cheap labor is not cheap, sort of intrinsically. The cheapness of cheap labor is constructed, and it's constructed by gendered assumptions and practices, including, as she points out, the notion that women are natural sowers, that they're actually secondary wage earners rather than primary breadwinners, so you can pay them less because you assume that they've got a husband who's actually providing for them, and that's part of the justification for the differential wages in some of these industries. And what this does is that it produces the flexibility of global fashion companies to produce products. I'm struck here that, in a way, we kind of echoed this argument when we were first thinking about Harry Potter, and the argument that you and Ivor made in the introduction to that book, where this is a big global phenomenon and we ought to have something to say about it. There's a precursor of that, I think, here. Blue jeans are a huge product. The global fashion industry does all of these things. We should have something to say about it. At the time she's writing this, originally writing this in 1980, nobody was talking about this. Now we do have, there's an edited volume on the global politics of fashion. There's been a few more things that have sort of come out within international relations. Let me caveat that. Nobody was talking about this in international relations. People were talking about it in other places, right? But like in terms of the field, the way that international relations as a subfield of political science was constituted, like nobody was talking about this stuff. And so Enlow comes along and says, no, we need to talk about this stuff. These are big global phenomena. And simply to say, oh, this is just an economic, comparative advantage argument because labor there is cheaper than capital or whatever. Enlow says, no, the cheapness of labor is produced. And as the cheapness of labor is produced, it said on page 259, no one's labor is automatically cheap. It has to be made cheap. It's like, okay, there. Once you have that, then you have an input into the kind of standard, comparative advantage economic stuff. But you only get that because of all this prior political work that's been done and cultural work that's been done to code certain kinds of labor as cheap. Where, and I've made this point before, I'll make it again, the next sentence there on 259, it is the deliberate manipulation of ideas about girls and women and notions of femininity that empowers those who try to cheapen women's labor. I'm not entirely sure you need the word deliberate in that sentence. If you did it without the word deliberate, it is the manipulation of ideas about girls and women and notions of femininity that empowers those who try to cheapen women's labor. I'm not sure the sentence, at least for me, loses much without the word deliberate in it. It's clearly important for her. She put it in there. But again, that's back to that. I think it's back to that doubleness of what exactly is the claim here. What exactly is the takeaway point that she wants here. It's more than just cheapness is constructed. It's also cheapness is constructed by someone and should be opposed. So there's a set of follow-ons here, going back to that hacking ladder, where she definitely wants us to do stage two and stage three, and not just stage one.
I assume one of the updates to this chapter, because it couldn't have been written in the original version, is the horrific Bangladesh fire, yeah, right, that killed a whole lot of workers, and I think primarily female workers, yeah, right? And one of my co-bloggers at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, Eric Loomis, has a really good kind of popular book about the sort of outsourcing of poor labor standards and the outsourcing of poor environmental standards, the outsourcing of pollution, essentially, because we don't do it anymore, but then our companies move to places that have very permissive regulatory environments and do stuff like this. And she draws this comparison. She talks about how it's like the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, et cetera, et cetera. The reason I invoke this is, not only does it, I think, underscore the continued gender dynamics of what she's talking about many years later, but also this is primarily a work about, feminist curiosity, it is in fact embedded in a variety of different critical traditions here. And so for her, and this is an important point if you're reading this book as somebody who's not an IR theorist, because I think you very well could, this is a book that you can read if you're not an IR theorist. There's a commitment to kind of baseline critique of capitalism, a baseline critique of other structural isms that for her go along with a feminist sensibility. And this is another thing where potentially you could decouple some of the architecture and probably get to a very similar kind of place.
Yeah.
I think.
No, I think so. I think I would agree with that characterization. So we are deliberately, Enlo is deliberately, I don't know, what's the word I want? She's sort of trespassing across different kinds of traditions. And there is a somewhat refreshingly eclectic attitude here. I'm going to grab things that help me make the points that I'm going to make, and I'm not going to say that's cordoned off into the specialized area called critical political economy, so I can't touch that. No, instead I'm going to pull points, and I'm going to, if it's this sort of critical gesture, I'm going to utilize that same kind of critical gesture in order to get where I want to go. Which goes back to something we've mentioned before in this discussion, that there's a very different approach here to theory, a very different approach to explanation, a very different approach to what it means to be doing something like critical scholarship or scholarship in general. And I think that's perhaps the biggest thing to take away from this is that attitude. I mean, feminist curiosity is not just it's not a method. It's not an off-the-shelf technique that you can take and apply to some data sets and get something out of it. It's a different way of understanding what you are doing when you're involved in scholarly production and what the consequences of that should be.
All right, I think there's not much else to say about this chapter.
Not much about this chapter.
So anyway,
by the way, I've had a lot of scotch.
So have I. That's like, I was going to drive into my office after this.
No, you're because not.
I was going to get some of those books we talked about.
Yeah, we're going to.
I have this nice little Monoprice power bank that also will take 60 watts of USB-C.
Ooh.
So that could be useful here.
Yeah, that could
right?
be.
I think maybe.
That might be tomorrow.
Yeah, it might be. Well, we're not. We're actually supposed to not come in after tonight for a while. I think because they have move out dates now for the undergraduates.
Well, our undergrads are going to be gone by the 23rd of March. So what I'm figuring at this point, and my computer won't come in until after that anyway, I figure it'll probably be that next week that I would go
it's
in.
All about the new power book, the new power book, the new power book,
yes,
right?
Exactly. Because once that shows up, I'm going to need that because then I can transfer it and so on. But yeah, but my copy of Campbell is there. The thing we have to do with Campbell is we're going to have to figure out, because there's two editions.
I have the first edition, I think.
I also have the first edition. The second edition has the new afterword or the new last chapter. It might.
So you're thinking we should just, worst comes worst, we just buy it on Kindle?
Well, I think actually what we should do, because the problem is that the first chapter has one of the best empirical chapters, which is the chapter about disease rhetoric and the Japanese purchase of real estate in New York.
Oh.
Which was then spun off into something else. But that's a great chapter. And the conclusion in the second edition is kind of a ranty thing about the way that constructivism has marginalized identity.
Does he talk about leaving the discipline and becoming a photographer?
He gestures in that direction. So
it's amazing. Like, he became a photographer. Bradley Klein designs golf courses, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, we lost some of our most capable minds in critical IR.
Brad was amazing. Brad Klein was amazing, but, you know, I guess he's...
All these people who we sort of look to, although, I mean, my work wouldn't be recognizable to any of them as remotely critical, but were really important to us intellectually. They're all, like, off doing other things. They were driven out of the discipline.
Oh, exactly. No, I mean, Campbell was one of the people that I was originally planning to work with. When I had my list of people, it was like... He was at Hopkins at the time, and so it's why I applied to Hopkins' PhD program. And he told me at that point that he was going to be leaving, and so I shouldn't go.
How widely acknowledged is it that writing security is probably the urtext of securitization, not the Copenhagen School?
Not very. Not very. Huh. I mean, it's security. There's no love lost between the securitization people and the post-structural security studies people.
Well, that's true of, like, Barry, but is that really true of Olay? And certainly it's not true of Thierry and the later kind of...
Yeah, but you know, they don't cite
infinite
Campbell.
Articles in security dialogue about the various derivations of security.
Yeah, but a lot of the people who self-identify as securitization scholars don't cite Campbell.
That's really fucked up.
It is, isn't it? Like they cite the waiver and Yop and whatever the heck that, and Bouzon.
Well, certainly important work, yeah. And clearly the analytical architecture that everybody takes as a springboard is you know, right. Bouzon, Yop,
right.
Waiver. But it's writing security, yeah, that makes these arguments.
And writing initially. Security was what Martin and I, like when we did the Civilizations book, like we deliberately pushed for writing Civilizations as the title. Like, because that's what we wanted.
I didn't realize. You know, I'm in that volume and I had no idea.
That was a very deliberate decision on our part. Like, we wanted to echo what Campbell had done. So, I love that book. I think that book is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it's great. So. And it, you know, the chapter on the war on drugs is still the best illustration I can think of for undergraduates of securitization dynamics.
Yep.
I mean, obviously, climate's more present for them, but the war on drugs, because you have the Fourth Amendment exception to the exclusionary yep. rule. You yep. have an actual codification
yes.
of a state of exception mm-hmm. into American legal doctrine based on securitization.
Totally.
All right, we should get back to Enloe. I will warn you, I probably am going to use this as an afterwards.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really. We'll see.
My conversation with Maya about chicken is going to be part of the afterward, or just this stuff about Campbell?
Well, look, we're talking about Enloe here, right? And my partner, who is smarter than I am, more analytically capable than I am, is cooking dinner. Why is she cooking dinner? She likes to cook dinner, right? So why does she like to cook dinner? Is that gendered politics? Mm.
Absolutely.
I don't know, right? I mean, there certainly is a way in which the nice thing about feminist scholarship is it all turns in on, because as she concludes the book, the international is political and the international is personal and the personal is international.
Well, and just to riff on that for a second, like, obviously we're marooned at home here because of coronavirus. And mm-hmm. so, of course, we're cooking rather than eating out. And when we're cooking, it's interesting because usually what ends up happening is my cooking is when we're grilling something. And so when we're grilling, then I can go and cook it. But the default assumption, and my wife is a pastor. She has 2 master's degrees. I mean, she's an incredibly intelligent, capable person who does all kinds of things. But the gender role of cooking, which has a lot to do with prior socialization and experience and so on. And all of that coding is like in the house. And where did that come from? If we take Enloe seriously, then all of that coding that's gender politics. That's the effect of gender politics. So even for, you know, 2 middle-aged white guys who are academics who are deliberately going out of the way to discuss a feminist text, it's still the case that our wives are doing the cooking.
Well, it's worse than that in my end because Maya doesn't even... I don't grill, right? I'm a
right.
Those of you who don't know me, I'm a vegetarian. So... mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my wife and my daughter aren't, so I don't even do the grilling. Maya does the grilling. The one place I break gender roles is I do a lot of the kind of deep cleaning in the house. Mm. But part of that is we outsource a lot of our cleaning to hire domestic help.
Which gets us, interestingly, into the next chapter of Enloe's
book. Well, before we get there, though, because we are definitely segueing there.
But that was a total great segue.
But there's another thing about sort of this issue about the relationship between Marxist critiques of capitalism and feminism, right? So, and I think this is the COVID-19 thing. So think about this. So right now, you say we're all cooking at home. And that's clearly the case. Many of us are cooking at home, although apparently all the Gen Zers and millennials are out partying for St. Patrick's Day in New York or whatever. But that being said, so one of the issues for us is that there are a couple of local businesses we normally patronize, right? One of which is an Ethiopian grocery store, another which is a Salvadoran restaurant. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of debating, do we patronize these places as a way of making sure that they continue to get revenue during a difficult time, or do we not patronize them because food prep is a disease vector, right? You know, we would get takeout from them, presumably. Mm-hmm. So lack of participation in the capitalist economy has racial dynamics in gender dynamics.
Yes.
If you think about the people who are engaged in service at these restaurants, for example, or these places.
Right.
So it's even more complicated than that, right?
Well, we have people who do our lawn care, all of whom are recent immigrants to the United States whose first language is not English. And next week, they're coming to do a spring cleanup. And on the one hand, no, if everybody's quarantining, then people shouldn't be like out doing these things. On the other hand, their livelihood depends on this because this is all, you know, slightly off the books kind of labor, right? It's day labor stuff. And so what do we do? Do we have them come because we know that this is how they're actually going to be able to sustain themselves, or do we not because it's a disease factor? So same kind of
dilemma. Where we are incredibly privileged,
yes.
Right? I mean,
absolutely.
Yes, if things go really far south, we could see salary freezes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is that we have very stable employment.
Yep.
We have jobs that can be converted sort of to teleworking,
mm-hmm.
And we're salaried.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. And it does give us this incredible privilege. And the question is, what is our ethical responsibility toward those who depend on the kind of surplus income that we're able to spend?
And is our ethical responsibility best fulfilled by participation in a capitalist economy, right? And this is where I think the fact that I'm really a New Deal liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, a Warren liberal, right? We need to, Howard Dean, I think, actually yep. channeled this best in 2004. We need to save capitalism from itself. We need to harness the market. And when the market doesn't get us good social results, we choose other things.
Yes.
But capitalism left to its own devices eats itself and causes misery.
Yes.
So I think that, you know, I have a little bit of an out there,
mm-hmm.
right? But
yeah,
I don't know. So this is really, as you were trying to say earlier before I made us derail further, this is a great segue to scrubbing the globalized tub.
Exactly.
Domestic servants in world politics, which is primarily, I think, about, not exclusively, but primarily about domestic service in the Gulf states.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it tends to be the empirical.
Which, as we all know, is a horror show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. No, but building on the argument from Chapter 7 about cheap labor being constructed via gender assumptions, Chapter 8, domestic labor of all sorts, is a particular kind of social construction, a particularly gendered construction. And she argues, and Lowe argues, that that helps explain why it's less visible, less regulated, and as abusive as it can be, particularly in these Gulf state situations. So, page 315, feminized housework, paid and unpaid, is often portrayed as timeless. It is not. The feminization of any sort of work is a process that goes on in political history and in gendered international political history. Which is fascinating because she takes the political history and then she adds to it gendered and international, right? Suggesting that the whole way in which we think of certain things as being women's work is a product not just of political history and not just of gender political history, but of international gendered political history. So that there are these components of broad boundary crossings that are connected to this, not just in the fact that it is imported foreign labor that's often doing these kinds of jobs, but the idea that, back to something we were talking about before in terms of the work that someone like Ann Townes has done on how the status of women is always part of the status, this standard of civilization kind of argument, designating certain categories of work as being appropriate work for civilized people to perform versus the kind of work you need to import other people to perform is connected again to these sorts of international political dynamics and dimensions of boundering and othering. So,
and then again, you have this idea that everything needs that feminist curiosity
mm-hmm.
shows us the way in which all politics is international, and all politics is international.
Yes,
and all There's got to be a flip side to that, but I'm not thinking of it.
Well, all conceptions of the international are political. The fact that we think of certain things as international and other things as domestic is itself a political distinction.
I can always count on you, Patrick. But she has then, in this vein, a discussion of the construction of the house and the design of households, right? Mm-hmm. Because households are designed at one point middle-class households with the assumption of having a domestic servant, a farm girl who's going to come in and work. Maya grew up in an old Victorian house in Rouse's Point, which is a small town located on the Canadian border north of Plattsburgh, which had a back stairwell for the local farm girl who was the domestic laborer. Or maybe they're outfitted in a way where the man has a sanctuary and the wife is doing the work, and all of these things change across time and space. But they're all caught up in the politics of domesticity.
Absolutely.
And they always have this highly gendered component. And you can then expand this outward if you think about the political economy, the materials that produce the house, which I don't think she actually goes there, but you can go all these different kinds of places mm-hmm. with this kind of argument.
No, exactly. It's the idea of taking, if there's a recommendation here for how one should do one's work, scholarly work, then the recommendation seems to be take something that's perfectly ordinary and examine the sets of connections that make it ordinary. So how is it, you talk about the back staircase of the house that Maya grew up in the house that my parents had in Jaffrey, New Hampshire, which was a Victorian house, there were two staircases. There was clearly a front staircase, and there was a staircase off the kitchen. And the staircase off the kitchen went to the second floor, but right in front of the staircase off the kitchen on the second floor, there was another door, and that door went up into the attic. And in the attic, there was a separate room. Now, you know, for me as a 12-year-old kid, this was awesome.
Oh, that's amazing. That's awesome, right?
Yeah, because I was like, this is great. Because that was my room. Like, that was my little retreat space. But when it was explained to me, like, why does this room exist? Well, this was the servant's room. So this is where they would live. And the staircase up the back was precisely so they wouldn't be seen in the other areas of the house when they were off duty. So it's literally built into the architecture of the way that these houses were designed. And this is a, you know, house in small town New Hampshire. So this wasn't, you know, and you're talking about a house near Plattsburgh, right? So these are not, we're not talking about these things necessarily just as existing in like the, you know, urban imperial centers. This was a mode of life that is widely distributed and has these very concrete gendered assumptions built into it about who's doing what kind of work.
And let's be clear that in many of these settings, it would be a farm girl. That is, it would be a surplus child, right, from who was not needed to conduct, you know, it's not that women didn't perform agricultural work, but it would be a surplus child who was not needed to produce the agricultural work on the farm and therefore could earn a living in a house in the city or the town in this case, right?
And what's also interesting then is if we take, because most of Endless Chapter is not about the Victorian era, right?
It's not. Yeah, obviously.
No. But what's interesting is what our discussion here has just kind of excavated is the creation of certain kinds of gendered social spaces for doing certain kinds of labor, which then after farm girls are taken out of that labor by various things like the expansion of female suffrage and changes that go on in the United States in the early part of the 20th century to sort of change the way in which that kind of gendering is done, who is then brought in to fill those spaces? Well, the people brought in to fill those spaces are then foreign workers. So then you have the mutation of the farm girl into the au pair. And that whole process of changing the particular individuals who occupy those positions, but keeping the social positions the same, which then that becomes kind of the backdrop to what she's actually talking about here in Chapter 8. Now, granted, most of her empirics in Chapter 8 are not about the United States. They're about the Gulf states. But I think there's an interesting parallel here, at least in terms of, I mean, I have no experience of living in the Gulf states, but I certainly have experience of domestic laborers being largely non-English speaking or not English as their first language.
Well, ethnically
language.
Other,
ethnically
right?
Other.
Which is to say, people who, for some people in the United States, are not properly American.
Precisely. Precisely.
It's interesting here because, I mean, now we're totally in riff mode, but this is kind of part of Enlow's point, is that, so the gendering of that labor helps to make it cheap.
Yes.
Right. And modern in the developed world, the maintenance of a, what we call an upper middle class lifestyle, but which is really a lower upper class lifestyle, mm-hmm. right? If you look at the income tables, depends upon labor, certain kinds of outsourced labor being cheap enough to be able to afford it. So it depends upon your lawn care being cheap enough. It depends upon your domestic labor, your cleaning lady being cheap enough so that you can, so that it is cheap enough that it is more valuable to you to have that time than to have that money, right? And so the gender, in the ways in which gender works throughout this system of production to enable that, I think she does a nice job of calling attention to, albeit often in a different context than what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. No,
and then we could also add racialization yeah. provides a role in, you know.
Oh, yeah. And this is back to the point you've been making consistently here about the intersectionality of Enlow's work, which is clearly on display. There's no exclusivity claimed here for gender dynamics as being the sole key that makes things, that unlocks explanations and opens things up to us. Although, given the intersectionality of race and gender, and given the feminization of the ethnically other, it seems like starting in either place is going to get you to both. And so it's not surprising that as Enlow starts to ask these kinds of questions about where are the women, what you run into are these sorts of racial dynamics as well, which are often wrapped up with the feminizing of the non-dominant race. So you have these things kind of coming together in sort of fascinating and disturbing ways.
The conclusion now, yes. And I will say that something we both talked about when we were talking about how to structure this podcast, obviously anything we talk about structure for this podcast except for following chapter by chapter completely falls by the wayside, a combination of both our own innate discursiveness and the alcohol. You know, so Patrick and I are trying to replicate the experience of being in the same room, which gets you, I think, a better vibe. And we're doing that by FaceTiming as we record separately. And so Patrick, I should note, just raised his glass of whiskey and drank some more. And I'm about to do the same after I'm done talking. But the key point is that we both mentioned that there's a way in which, in some respects, the book for us kind of peters out as you go on. And I think that's a function of the fact that I think she makes her point very persuasively fairly quickly. So I'm convinced by the second or third chapter that gender is constituent of all these things and that intersectionality matters. We need to understand that gender is at work in all of these systems of oppression and power, and what is international relations if not about power? So it's all about international relations, and also all of these things we think of as domestic are internationalized, and the very thinking about them as domesticized is in part a gender construct that allows us to hive them off from international politics as we, being trained in a certain kind of perspective, assume international politics to be. Okay, so in that sense, we're convinced three chapters in.
Right.
And it can get a little bit kind of like, okay, we're convinced. But nonetheless, here we are at the conclusion, which is called The Personal is International, The International is Personal. And Enlow will explain for you in this chapter, if you don't know the feminist resonance, that this is essentially a recoding of the personal as political and the political as personal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Any thoughts about this conclusion?
Well, the sentence for me that really ties it together is on page 350. The implications of a feminist understanding of international politics are thrown into sharper relief when one reads the personal is international the other way around. The international is personal. This calls for a radical new imagining of what it takes for governments to ally with each other, to compete with, and wage war against each other. What I find fascinating about the construction of that sentence is, or those two sentences, is in the second sentence, the things that she says require a radical new imagining are the core concerns of mainstream non-feminist IR, right? Governments allying with each other, competing with each other, and wage war against each other. So what do you have there? You've got alliance politics, you've got political economy, you've got war. So you have the basic sets of concerns that the traditional kind of mainstream or maelstrom IR has been concerned with up to this point. And she says, no, if you really take the feminist understanding seriously, then we have to imagine those things entirely differently. And we have to imagine, it's like that, the formulation on page 350 is almost the less radical formulation, because she says we have to imagine those things differently because the conditions of possibility for those things require us to take account of gender. And that, I think, is the culmination of what I've been calling throughout this conversation the kind of explanatory strain of the book. Like, we cannot understand these things that you're already interested in unless we take these gender dynamics seriously. But I think there's a more radical version of this that comes out near the end of the conclusion, which is maybe those aren't the things we should be concerned about in international studies. Maybe we should be thinking about international studies not just as being about the explanation of those kinds of things, but that we have to actually expand the whole definition of like what counts as international studies. And that, I think, is more that second agenda of let's take the experience of women in world politics, which has been traditionally marginalized, and elevate that to a center point. And then view all of these things from a very different kind of perspective. So that, I think, is a really good, like, she's still got both of those agendas going on all the way through the conclusion of the book.
I think that's also one thing that interests me about that is it's sort of the dilemma that I think, obviously, feminist theory and feminist studies in IR is now its own subgenre, mm-hmm. which means that feminists working in IR no longer need to, well, I'm sure, okay, I got to caveat this because I'm going to get into trouble. We all agree that international relations has been fragmented a lot in the last 20, 25 years. Is that right, Patrick?
I would agree.
Now, it's always been, there have always been complaints about it being fragmented. We can go back to Almond's, what is it, who wrote the Separate Tables presidential address to APSA? Almond is Clouds and Clocks, so I don't think it's Almond.
No.
We can look this up after the fact, whatever. The important point is that there have always been complaints about the fragmentation of the field, so clearly it's always been fragmented. But it's become particularly fragmented in recent years because people figured out that the cost of setting up a journal became relatively low, and the cost of setting up a section became relatively low. So people figured out we can set up our own sections with professional organizations. We can set up our own journals, and then we don't have to constantly prove that the mainstream needs to pay attention to us, whatever the mainstream is. So yes, it's awesome if you can publish an IO, maybe ISQ, certainly IO, doing feminist work, but you don't have, your tenure doesn't necessarily depend upon it if there are journals that are going to be receptive to that outlet anyway. And you get sort of communities of sub-talk, which is great because you get much more progress with the appropriate scare quotes if you've got people who are talking to each other, working on the same stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You get a lot more kind of, if they don't have to be constantly translating their work for other people or proving that they matter to other people. On the other hand, you know, it can be bad because it means that you increasingly decouple, and so people who are mainstream don't ever feel like they have to pay attention to you at all. Like before, you may be impinged on their consciousness once in a while. Now they can just safely ignore you because you can safely ignore them, and you know that has effects on what the contours of the discipline are. Anyway, I'm babbling. The basic point I want to make here is that there is a tension in this book. We like tensions. Right? There's tension in this book between, hey, look, the things you care about, you have to understand gender to care about. And if we take gender seriously, we should care about other shit, other stuff. And this is where I'm more mainstream, I'm sorry to say. I actually really like the critical argument. I like the argument that says, heck, you can't understand the things you think are important without understanding gender. I'm more interested in that, I think, than I am in the things that gender opens us up to.
Yeah, and I
and maybe that's a failing on my part, but I like kind of taking the fight to the mainstream a little bit more than I like going off and doing the non-mainstream thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I find myself in a similar kind of place. Oh, and parenthetically, I just looked it up. It was Gabriel Almond.
I can remember those things we read in 1995 in grad school. That's right. Amazing.
1988 showed up in PS, separate tables. So it was an argument about political science, not just about international relations. But it's, I think of, you know, Holstie's work on the separate fragmentation of the discipline. So nothing that contradicts anything that you said before. But no, I mean, I'm more interested in looking at the kinds of explanations that exist in mainstream scholarship and saying you don't understand what you're doing unless you take these other kinds of factors into account. And I think part of that is sort of the way I was formed, the way we were formed as scholars. I mean, I'll get super autobiographical for a second, right? Because when I was going to get my PhD, so I had two offers that were roughly comparable. And one of them was from Columbia, and one of them was from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And I had had conversations with folks at both places about the kinds of things that they did in their programs. And the advice that I got, I mentioned Professor Schechter at the beginning here as the person I read Enloe with, but the advice I got from Mike Schechter, who was a Columbia alum, he'd been a Bob Cox student when Bob was at Columbia, he said, if you go to Columbia, you will learn how to engage with the mainstream, and that will be something that will follow you for the rest of your scholarly career, that you will be engaging with the mainstream. If you go to Amherst, you can ignore the mainstream. And certainly at that time, if you look at sort of what University of Massachusetts Amherst was at that point in time, I mean, I had a conversation with like Jim Derderian about this. It was, you know, they were doing a very different thing. And I deliberately made the choice to go to Columbia. And part of that was because what I wanted to do was engage with that mainstream and show them that there were problems. And that, I think, is where I'm on the same page as you are in terms of what I take away from something like this. I'm interested in making space for people to ignore the mainstream. But myself, what I'm interested in
is
that.
It's funny, I got the same exact advice at Harvard, right? Because I've mentioned before, I think, that what really got me turned on back to IR was IR theory. And that was a joint product of taking part of the feminist theory sequence, and also taking courses with people like Ian Johnson, even Stephen Rosen, who were sort of had more eclectic understandings of what constituted IR theory. And so the combination of those two things helped get me back excited in the idea of being an academic, right? Being an academic studying international relations. So I had the exact same advice, right? You could go elsewhere, but it'll be harder for you to get a job, and you won't know how to speak because you won't know how to speak to the mainstream, right? So it was a little more instrumentally put for me. But I want to say here that a little bit of self-critique on this. So in the sections we're talking about, right, the two pages after the quotation you just read to me, where I did this long discursive intervention about how I kind of prefer the work that says, you know, you people who think you understand things like balances of power are wrong. And we need to study gender to really understand them, or we need to study race to really understand them, or what have you. Enloe goes on to say, power relations between countries and their governments involve more than troop maneuvers and diplomatic emails. Right. Then she goes even further, and she says that becoming aware that personal relationships have been internationalized, however, may make one feel guilty for not having paid enough attention to international affairs. You should know more about the IMF. Don't switch channels when experts start talking about climate change. Find out where Guam is. While useful, this new international attentiveness by itself is not sufficient. It leaves untouched our conventional presumptions about just what international politics is and where it takes place. Coming to realize that the personal is international expands the politically attentive audience, but it fails to transform our understanding of what is happening on the multiple stages of international politics. Now, she says this, what, in the 1990s, early 1990s? An insight, like late 1980s then, an insight brought to her by a feminist scholar. Now, what do we have in the last 5 years? We have the practice turn. We have inattention to interpersonal relations. I have this piece about interpersonal relations and trust in international politics. All these people, Marcus Holmes, Carielli Milo, all the cognitive psych revolution, a big chunk of that is on interpersonal relations. It's on social psychology. It's on motor neurons and all this sort of stuff. While some of this isn't exactly the same thing, the basic point is that we've suddenly woken up to the idea that interpersonal relationships matter, and they matter a lot for the conduct of international politics, even in the more narrow domain of diplomacy and relationships between leaders, let alone in this broader domain. You know, I'm interested, for example, in how interorganizational relationships between, you know, sort of commandants and, you know, people at the lower levels of the bureaucracy, how the relationships they forge influence politics. So Enloe gets there way before the mainstream, and she gets there with Feminist IR, which says something about how important this kind of work is, right? And that we have to discover it to some degree on our own, or we read the Enloe and we sort of bracket that off. That's Feminist IR. And then we pat ourselves on the back when we discover things that Enloe was already telling us we ought to be studying, right?
Right. Right. And not just Enloe, but of course, lots of feminist scholars who said these sorts of things and were ignored. I mean, you know, to be super self-critical for a second, right? People cite our 1999 piece about relations, but like Feminist IR was talking about relations being before actors and states and entities like a long time before we said it. But, you know, that piece gets cited a lot. And I don't think it's bad that that piece gets cited a lot, but it's interesting and somewhat distressing that because of the gender dynamics of the field still, the kinds of things that many of these brilliant female scholars of a feminist inclination said have to wait to be rediscovered by other people years later. It was already there in what Enloe said in the late 80s. I mean, it's stuff that Tickner said. It's stuff that, you know, Joan Scott was saying the stuff about political economy.
Right. Although, to be fair, we've been cited 500 times. Vannetta's speeches and basis has been cited 5,600 times. But it's not cited for the purposes we just talked about generally. Right, it's cited either as a drive-by citation on Feminist IR, or it's cited by Feminist IR scholars, or it's cited outside of the discipline, would be my guess.
Yeah. There's a kind of feminist ghetto.
This is the tyranny of footnoting. Whose phrase was that?
Yes.
Is that Tickner?
Oh, God. Who said that?
It was somebody, some good Feminist IR scholars whose name is eluding us at the moment. Or whose attribution is eluding us at the moment.
No, but there's a way that I almost feel like it does this book a disservice to brand it Feminist IR, given the kind of academic, disciplinary, subdisciplinary ghettoization that could come along with the label. Like, this is just a good book of international studies. This is just a good study of international affairs. And it opens up vistas, which, to echo the point you made a minute ago, are vistas that we are now exploring. And she got there, God, how long ago was 1989?
Okay, well, let's be clear. We mean white males who are not mainstream but are part of the broader IR theory movement.
Correct.
Clear about that. I one last kind of thought on this.
We can edit out the silence. It's okay.
Well, that's where I always put in those interstitials.
Yes, yeah, it's good.
Right. Yeah, that is if there's a break, I have to cover over. What am I trying to say? Oh, boy.
We've had a lot of scotch.
I have no idea.
We've had a lot of scotch.
Oh, right. Yeah, so there's this, let's come back. I just, for me, my last thought has to do with the status of this as a work of IR theory, right? This is definitely, as you said early on, not Waltz, right? But it's not even Laura Schoberg or Ann Tickner or a lot of feminist IR theorists, right? There's very little jargon here, almost none. There's very little engagement. There's no acknowledgement. There's very little acknowledgement of a broader theoretical universe, right? Which is explicitly, right? I mean, there's implicit. They're saying you don't pay attention to this that matters. There's an implicit you, but she's not. There's no kind of like lump and dump a bunch of different IR theoretical perspectives. And to some degree, that makes that book much more enduring, right? Because those theoretical fads can come and go, and you can still read the book. You don't have to figure out, oh, wait, what do we mean by securitization theory? But on the other hand, as I said, it does in some respects, I think, make this, work of IR theory, a little bit frustrating at times. Doesn't it?
Well, it depends on, and this would be sort of my last take on it, it depends on what we think IR theory is and what it's for. And if IR theory is an endeavor in which what we're trying to do is progressively refine some kind of general understanding of the dynamics of international affairs, then it's hard to use this book to be able to do that. But if we think that, let me distinguish between IR theory and international theory, just as a provisional thing. So IR theory would be more the kind of endeavor that Waltz is engaged in. So you've got a domain, and we're trying to explain what goes on in that domain. I think Enloe's book is more a contribution to international theory, which is to say a theoretically informed understanding of a set of dynamics that involve boundary maintenance and boundary crossing. There's no single concise kind of proposition other than gender's important that comes out of this. But if what one is looking for from theory is not so much a specification of causes and effects, but if one is instead looking for a kind of conceptual sensibility, you know, I think of Enloe in this sense in the same way that I might think of like Nick Onuf, which is another book that we've discussed possibly doing at some point on this podcast. You know, Onuf doesn't have a set of propositions about international politics either, but there's a way of thinking about international affairs that comes out of it, and I think Enloe does something very similar to that. So a lot depends on kind of what we think theory is for, and what we think the punchline of doing theory is. And clearly Enloe has a much broader understanding of that than Waltz did.
I think that's right. I mean, we've said that before. I've also agreed with it. I think that's a good kind of coded end on. I will say that this is a book I would definitely teach.
Yeah.
Or at least excerpts from
Absolutely. It. Absolutely.
Because it's eminently readable by undergraduates. It makes some important points. If you're not exposed to some of these kinds of arguments before, it is really eye-opening and very compelling at times. You agree?
Yes. Having reread it for this, I'm rethinking the way I teach world politics, that I might put this in next time. I use an essay of hers, but I don't use the book. But I think next time I might actually assign the book, because I have... Again, having not read the second edition of it and having not read the first edition in a number of years, I had forgotten exactly how accessible it is. So
we mentioned books for next time, and we think we're leaning right now towards doing Chin's A Relational Theory of World Politics, mm-hmm. which is a book that neither of us have read, although we've read essays by him. And that's something that I think we should have a lot to say about, given that it's sort of in our wheelhouse, but not in our wheelhouse at the same time. Other possibilities we've talked about are Campbell's writing Security, but I think we're going to do Chin. The other thing we've talked about is maybe doing some, since we're stuck at home with our recording equipment, we thought we might do some interstitials where we would look at a particular article. If that appeals to you, be sure to let us know. I mean, probably we'll do it anyway because we're egotistical and all sorts of things. this and because we're really fucking bored.
This is true.
And socially deprived. But just to close this out, Patrick, where can people follow you on Twitter?
So they can follow me on Twitter at ProfPTJ.
And you have a website?
I do have a website, correct, which is kittenboo.com. And actually, this week I'm going to be putting up the series of lectures on philosophy of science that I did recently in Europe at the European Consortium on Political Research Winter Methods School. So I'll be putting up 6 one-hour lectures about philosophy of science.
Ooh, okay. So I am available at DHNexon. And conveniently enough, my main website is DHNexon.com. Net. And I also have a website for my new book, which is coming out in a couple of weeks. You can already order it on Kindle and read it right now, which is called Exit from Hegemony, and that's with Alex Cooley. And we have a website, exitfromhegemony.com. It's actually, I think we're trying to make it into a pretty good resource for tracking some of the major themes that we talk about in terms of processes that are eroding American international leadership. And given that we're stuck at home, Alex has recommitted and I have committed to providing more content at that website. So please do check it out. All right. Well, so that has been this has been another exciting episode of Whiskey and International Relations Theory. And as always, please do give us feedback and we hope you enjoyed it.
And see you next time.